a camera in the back with a bright light in my face. So I'm sorry if I squint. I forgot to bring sunscreen and sunglasses. If you're wondering why we're filming this, it's because Steven Spielberg is making a documentary on the kidney. What's so funny? And of course, they had to cast the right person, so they picked me. So Steven, would you like to say hello to the guys in the audience? Say hello to Steven. He's back there. Okay. If you're really good, he might sign autographs, but you really want my autograph at the end. So come see me. Forget about him. Okay, so to get serious for a minute. So far we've talked about sodium handling by the kidney. Yesterday we talked about regulation of volume. I know from a couple of emails that I got that some of you are a little confused about that. So my plan is working. And today we're going to talk about how the kidney regulates water. And at the same time, I'm going to try to clear up some of the confusion that naturally ensues every year from this series of lectures. So you might remember that there were a couple of points yesterday. There was one slide that a couple of people had some questions about, and we didn't quite finish the business with diuretics yesterday. So we have lots of time tomorrow. So tomorrow we're going to clear up that one confusing slide. If you know what it is, good for you. If not, I'll show you tomorrow. And we'll talk about diuretics tomorrow because we have time, and today we're going to focus on water. So the objectives for today are, one, to review how the kidney handles water, to understand how the kidney excretes water and conserves water, and to understand the basis of disordered water handling, because you'll find out clinically that there are sometimes problems with water handling that cause certain conditions, and if you don't understand how the kidney handles water, it's very difficult to understand what the disorder is. So the first point is to talk about what is it that the kidney regulates in terms of water regulation. What's being measured? And what's being measured is the plasma osmolarity, what we call the p-osm, and it's very closely regulated to remain constant and normal. So you can actually calculate the plasma osmolarity. You can also measure the plasma osmolarity, but it's very easy to calculate the plasma osmolarity from a very simple formula. It's just double the concentration of sodium plus the concentration of urea and the concentration of glucose. And unless there are other things in the plasma that are floating around that are not being measured, which we'll deal with in another lecture, then this really estimates the plasma osmolarity very closely. And if you measure the plasma osmolarity, which you can do by freezing point depression, and if you calculate it with this formula, they should agree very closely, within 10. You'll notice that it's double the sodium plus the urea plus the glucose. Now, the glucose is usually a very small number in the plasma, right? Normal glucose is like somewhere between, 3 and 5 or 4 and 6 or whatever you want. And the same for urea. So they really contribute to the plasma osmolarity, but they're quite small numbers. So you can see pretty easily that sodium is the principal determinant of the plasma osmolarity, right? The sodium is 140, and if you double the sodium, you're talking about 280, which is pretty much all of the plasma osmolarity. So that plasma osmolarity and sodium concentration are terms that can be used interchangeably to talk about the same thing, because the plasma osmolarity varies very directly with the sodium concentration, because that's the main determinant. Now notice that I'm talking about sodium concentration, not the amount of sodium. And sodium concentration, as you'll see, is not the same as the amount of sodium, which is really the volume, but we're going to leave that for a later slide. So plasma osmolarity is maintained constant by two main things, by the kidney's ability to modify water excretion. So the kidney can either excrete a lot of water or can conserve water by concentrating the urine. And the other mechanism that regulates water is thirst. So when we need to, we feel thirsty and we add water to our bodies. So if we ingest excess water, and you've all done this experiment, okay? You've done this experiment usually in the morning when you have, your usual 5 or 6 cups of coffee, or sometimes after an exam when you have a couple of beers. And, when you have a couple of beers, you hope that the bathroom works. because you're drinking a lot of fluid and you go to excrete a very dilute urine. So when you ingest excess water, the kidneys excrete the excess water as a dilute urine. And you know that it's a dilute urine because you can measure the urine osmolarity and it should be low. When the kidneys excrete water, we call this a water diuresis. A water diuresis is a fancy physiologic term for peeing out water. And this basically allows us to drink as much as we want, and even as we drink as much as we want, we'll still always maintain a normal plasma osmolarity because of this, the kidney's ability to excrete this water very well. On the other hand, sometimes we face a situation where we lose water. This might be a period of time when we're having a significant amount of vomiting and diarrhea. It might be, you know, that we're running a marathon in very hot weather or cycling to school on an unusually warm day in Montreal when it actually gets above zero. And you sweat when you exercise in warm weather, and you can lose a lot of water. So if we lose water, the kidneys switch around their role, and they conserve water by excreting a concentrated urine. We know that the urine is concentrated by looking at the osmolarity of the urine and seeing that it's high. And this is the opposite of a water diuresis, so we call this an antidiuresis, simply because it's the opposite. So the formation of a concentrated urine we refer to in physiology as an antidiuresis. And at the same time, when water loss occurs, we stimulate thirst. This makes us want to drink, and we in fact take in more water to replace the water that was lost. So this slide just shows you an example of what water normally comes in and what water normally goes out. So we can look at water intake. And first of all, I just want to point out that there's a certain amount of water that we ingest every day with food. And that's about a liter a day on average, because many, many foods that we eat are mostly water in content. You know, a lot of fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. And then we also produce some water from oxidative metabolism, about 300 cc's a day. And then on top of that, you can really ingest as much fluid as you want, but that put down, or this table put down, an average of about 1,200. So this comes out to about 2,500 of water intake on a typical day. Now, many people drink more and many people drink less. And then in terms of water loss, we have some insensible water loss, which is mostly from respiration. We also lose a little bit from sweat, even when we're not particularly warm. We lose some water in the feces, and then the rest of the water we pee out in the urine in order to stay in balance. So these things, the insensible sweat losses, fecal losses, are pretty constant from day to day. And whatever water we need to eliminate, which can vary and depends on how much water we take in here, we can just eliminate in the urine. Okay, so this is the flexible part and makes sure that we stay in water balance. So you can see this example shows perfect water balance, 2.5 liters of water in and 2.5 liters of water out. Yeah. The what?
Insensible losses.
Yeah.
What is it exactly?
It's from breathing. You lose some water in your respiration. Okay, so this is a cartoon that just makes the point again that like everything else, we stay in balance for water. And this guy hammering away is drinking 2.5 liters of water a day, and he's peeing out 2.5 liters of urine a day. And he's in perfect water balance. And the reason that he has to be in water balance is to keep the plasma osmolarity and the plasma sodium concentration normal. Okay. Now, sometimes water loss can be much more than the average. And this table just compares water loss at normal temperature with water loss on a hot day and with water loss during prolonged heavy exercise. And the main thing that changes on a hot day is that you sweat more, and if you exercise, and especially if you exercise on a hot day, you can sweat a lot more, and you lose a lot more water. And so you either, the more water that you lose, the more water you have to take in to replace it with thirst, and your kidney has to then concentrate the urine to prevent further water loss. So remember, when the kidney concentrates the urine, it can't really replace water that's lost, it just prevents further water loss. Okay, this is an example of this guy hammering on a hot day when he's sweating a lot, and he has to take in more water, or he'll excrete less water to stay in balance. Okay. So, as long as the water regulation system is operating normally, then the plasma osmolarity and the plasma sodium concentration will always remain constant. So that means that the plasma sodium concentration will always be around 140. We always talk about 140, but you keep in mind that, you know, normal values are always a range, so it could be anywhere between 135 and 145. And the plasma osmolarity is usually around 280 or 280 to 290. Now, sometimes you'll have a derangement of the water regulation system, and you'll retain excess water. Your body won't eliminate water normally. If that happens, then you'll have a fall in the plasma osmolarity, a fall in the plasma sodium concentration. When this happens, we refer to that as hyponatremia. So if someone can't get rid of water normally, then he'll be retaining water. The water he's ingesting won't be excreted as it should be, and the plasma sodium concentration will fall because the ECF is being diluted by the retained water. So instead of being 135 to 145, it might drop to 130. Depending on how severe the water retention is and how much water is being taken in, it could drop as low as 110 or 115. And the opposite can also happen if you're losing water from your body, and usually it's you're losing water and you're not able to replace it for whatever reason, then you can have an abnormally high sodium concentration, which we refer to as hypernatremia. Okay, so I just want to emphasize again, the changes in sodium concentration are the things, is what implies a problem with water balance. It doesn't imply a problem with sodium balance. So if you see someone with a serum sodium concentration of 110, okay, that doesn't tell you anything about the volume state of that patient. The patient can be normovolemic, or he can be hypovolemic, or he can be volume expanded. If you see someone with a serum sodium concentration that's low, like 110, that tells you that the person is retaining too much water because he's not excreting water as he should be. Okay, so you have to wrap your mind around that concept because intuitively it's always difficult. Yeah, question?
How can we differentiate between water regulation that we learned yesterday over sodium and water regulation?
Okay, good question. So hopefully by the end of today's lecture you'll have a better understanding of that. So give me a little more time, like another half hour approximately. Okay, so changes in sodium balance result changes in ECF volume. So what we mean by that is if you retain sodium, your volume goes up. If you lose sodium, your volume goes down. But changes in sodium concentration mean that you're either retaining water or losing water. So what's hard to understand is I separate the mechanisms that control volume and the mechanisms that control water into two separate lectures, because the control mechanisms are actually different, but it's all occurring at the same time. And that's what you have to try to understand and appreciate. So all of this stuff is happening dynamically at the same time. So if you retain more sodium, if your kidney has to retain more sodium to maintain your volume, you'll retain more water at the same time, because the two systems are working in parallel and very tightly with each other. And if the kidneys have to get rid of sodium, you'll have to get rid of water at the same time in order to maintain the plasma osmolarity and sodium concentration as normal. So any changes in sodium balance are always accompanied by appropriate adjustments in water to maintain a normal plasma osmolarity and plasma sodium concentration. I'll try to convince you that that's true by looking at some of these compartments. So you remember these crazy compartments, total body water, which you can divide into extracellular fluid and intracellular fluid, right? Right. Okay. So this is the ECF and this is the ICF on this diagram. So I just added this last night, so it's not in your notes, but it should be on whatever, you know, you can access this stuff, right? So this is the composition of the ECF and this is the composition of the ICF. So you know that sodium is excluded from the ICF because of the sodium potassium ATPase on this membrane. And the main cation in the ICF is potassium. You have very low sodium in the ICF, right? The osmolarity, though, is the same in both compartments, okay? And this membrane here is really the cell membrane or cell wall, which separates the ECF from the ICF. And water can move freely across this according to osmotic gradients. So it's the ECF that's always in equilibrium and it's affected by the external environment. So if you take in sodium, it goes into the ECF. If you take in water, it goes into the ECF first, right? If you lose fluid, if you're losing it from the ECF, whether it's urinary losses or GI losses from something like diarrhea. So the ECF interfaces with your external environment. And when we're talking about adding sodium, losing sodium, adding water, losing water, we're talking about it in the ECF. So let's look at these compartments again. And let's say you're taking in more sodium, either because you're eating more salt, you decide, you know, you're increasing your sodium intake, or I stick an IV in you and I'm giving you a saline load. So I'm adding sodium to you. Okay, where does that sodium go? It goes into the ECF, right? Because that's where all the sodium stays. Does it go into the ICF? No, it doesn't go into the ICF because there's very, very little sodium in the ICF. And the sodium-potassium pump is always excluding sodium from the ICF. So if I add sodium, I'm adding it to the sodium chloride or salt, I'm adding it to the ECF, and I'm expanding the extracellular fluid compartment. So when I add some sodium to the ECF, what happens? Immediately, there's a small rise in the osmolarity, right? So instead of being 280 here and 280 here, this will go up a little bit, maybe to 285. And these changes are very, very brief and very, very transient. So it's not like, okay, I'm eating salt, so now my ECF osmolarity is 285. As the salt is added, it's causing an increase in the osmolarity of the ECF, but it's being compensated for very quickly. And because the osmolarity goes up here and becomes higher than the osmolarity in here, the first thing is you get a shift of some water from the ICF into the ECF. Okay? And that'll restore the osmolarity to normal, or it'll mitigate the increase in osmolarity. But then, you know, that's not a really good compensation mechanism, right? Because you don't want every time you add sodium to the ECF to suck your ICF dry. It's a good short-term move, but it's not a good long-term move. So what happens is, after you add sodium, this increased osmolarity also stimulates thirst, and we haven't gone over these mechanisms yet, but I just want you to understand this before I go through the actual mechanisms. It will increase thirst, so you drink. And at the same time, it increases something, as we'll see in a minute, called antidiuretic hormone, which tells your kidney to concentrate the urine. And the effect of both of these things is to add water to the ECF. So this is just an example of how, if someone is in positive sodium balance for whatever reason, at the same time, water is added appropriately. Why is water added appropriately? Whoops, what did I do here? Because the addition of sodium chloride changes the osmolarity, which brings about changes in the water handling system to add the appropriate amount of water. The exact opposite will happen if you lose sodium. Yeah? Okay. Very good. So if you're adding a solution of salt and the appropriate amount of water, then you won't change the osmolarity. It's a very astute observation, and I thank you for pointing that out. You're correct. So I should just say salt and not say saline. You're right. Okay, is this sort of clear? On the other hand, if someone just drinks water, okay, because people get mixed up, I think, because, you know, when you look at your blood, it's like liquid. So you think it's water, right? You think of body fluids, you think of water all the time. But your body fluids are not only made up of water. So if you add water to the ECF, this will bring about a fall in osmolarity in the ECF, and you'll now have an osmolar gradient for water to move here. So if you add water to the ECF, you're not bringing about any major volume change in the ECF. What you're actually doing is expanding total body water. Most of the water that you ingest goes into the ICF because that's where most of the water is. Most of your total body water is in the ICF. Okay? So it's not water that restores volume. Okay? Keep that in mind. Okay, so let's look at how the kidney handles water. And there are basically three key elements of water handling, and I'm going to run through them. The first is the kidney has to be able to make a dilute urine. And the kidney does that, and I'll show you in the nephron in a minute exactly where and how. But just take it, accept it at face value for a minute. The nephron is able to generate dilute urine, and it does this in the thick ascending limb of Henle and in the distal tubule. And you may remember that when we talked about sodium handling two lectures ago, I mentioned that in those segments, sodium is reabsorbed, but it's impermeable to water. So you're removing solute from the urine, and water stays behind, so you're making a dilute urine. So you're always making a dilute urine in those two segments. Then you need a hypertonic interstitium, and I'll show you what that means in a minute, to provide a gradient for water absorption. And then you have to have a way to control the permeability of the collecting duct, and that's done by this hormone, antidiuretic hormone. Okay. So before we look at those mechanisms in more detail, how do we sense plasmaosmolarity? Well, the body senses plasmaosmolarity by having specialized cells called osmoreceptors. And these cells are actually neurons that are located in the hypothalamus, and they have quite long axons that go from the hypothalamus into the posterior pituitary. These neurons actually synthesize antidiuretic hormone, and they can release antidiuretic hormone from the end of their axons in the posterior pituitary. So these specialized neurons can sense plasmaosmolarity, and in response to plasmaosmolarity, they can decide whether to release or not release antidiuretic hormone. These osmoreceptors are very sensitive, and they detect changes in osmolarity of 1% or less. Okay, so it doesn't take a big change in osmolarity to either shut off antidiuretic hormone or to trigger antidiuretic hormone. Okay, I think I already said this, so we'll move along. So this is a wonderful, sort of confusing picture. This is a brain, not a kidney. This is the pituitary over here, and the hypothalamus is over here. And so you have these specialized neurons, these osmoreceptor neurons in the supraoptic nucleus or whatever of the hypothalamus, and they function as osmoreceptors. And then their axons go all the way. This is a blow-up where you can see these axons going down into the posterior pituitary. So antidiuretic hormone is actually released from the posterior pituitary, but the sensor is really in the hypothalamus. Okay? Okay. So any increase in plasmaosmolarity will stimulate antidiuretic hormone secretion. Even a 1% increase in plasmaosmolarity will stimulate ADH secretion. And it's not an all-or-none thing. It's a graded response. So the size of the ADH response is proportional to the increase in plasmaosmolarity. The other key thing about antidiuretic hormone control is once the plasmaosmolarity falls below 280, then ADH release shuts off completely. And ADH, when it's around, it makes the collecting duct permeable to water. It does that by inserting water pores into the collecting duct membrane, into the collecting duct cells. These water pores are called aquaporins, and they're inserted into the apical membrane of the collecting duct cells. And when this happens, they become permeable to water. If there's no ADH around, these aquaporins are not there, and the collecting duct is completely impermeable to water. And ADH also stimulates thirst to increase water intake. So if there's no ADH around, then the collecting duct is not permeable to water, and you can't get reabsorption of water, even though you have a gradient to reabsorb it. And the absence of ADH allows us to excrete a dilute urine. So like everything else, it can't be completely straightforward. It has to be at least a little bit more confusing than it should be. So although the principal regulator of ADH is the plasmaosmolarity, there's also some baroreceptor input to ADH release. So those cells that release ADH are also influenced by baroreceptors in a way that if effective circulating volume falls significantly, and it has to be a significant fall, so a little bit of volume depletion won't do it. It has to be a substantial fall in effective circulating volume. Then the baroreceptors will trigger the release of ADH, and what they're really trying to do is conserve water just because they feel that there's a serious volume threat. So these are examples. Actually, the top panel is the most important one. And this graph shows you the plasma ADH level and graphed against the plasma osmolarity. So you can see here, first of all, and this is one of the key things, when the plasma osmolarity is 280 or below, ADH is shut off completely. If the plasma osmolarity rises above 280, then you get a graded ADH response. If it rises a tiny bit, you get a little bit of ADH. If it rises a lot more, you get a lot more ADH. Okay, so the ADH release response to increased osmolarity depends on how severe the increase in osmolarity is. If someone wants to talk to me, they're going to have to wait. Okay, let's leave it at that. Okay, now this is a nephron. And don't worry, I'm going to walk you through this nephron, so don't get freaked out by all the numbers up there. And this is a nephron, and it illustrates, as we walk through it, you'll see what happens with a water diuresis and antidiuresis. So let's look at a water diuresis first. So when you filter at the glomerulus, the glomerular filtrate is isoosmotic, right? The osmolarity is 285 as it is in normal plasma. And by the end of the proximal tubule, it's still 285 because you're absorbing water and solute together, sodium and chloride water together, and it's isoosmotic. Osmolarity hasn't changed. There is a gradient of osmolarity in the interstitium. The interstitium means the space between all the tubules, so that it goes from about isoosmolarity up in the cortex down to a maximum osmolarity of about 1,200 by the time you get to the medulla of the kidney. And the descending limb of Henle's loop is permeable to water, so water just moves out, and this equilibrates passively with this concentration gradient. And it's in the thick ascending limb of Henle's loop in the distal tubule where you're reabsorbing sodium in a segment of the nephron, which is not permeable to water, so you're now generating dilute urine or hypoosmolar fluid. So you can see the osmolarity goes down to 200, 100, 90, 80 by the time you get to the end of the distal tubule. Okay? So you generate what's potentially dilute urine. And now this dilute urine that you've generated here has to get outside. It has to go through the collecting duct and has to run the gauntlet. Would someone like my beeper? Because this is driving me crazy. It has to run the gauntlet of this high concentration in the renal interstitium. So you know that you can see that there's a tremendous gradient from here to here, a tremendous osmotic gradient. So if the collecting duct is permeable to water, you should be reabsorbing a lot of water across this concentration gradient. So if ADH is absent, if ADH is suppressed, then you'll be able to excrete this as a dilute urine because it will be able to go through the collecting duct without water reabsorption occurring, and you can have a water diuresis. Okay? What happens with an antidiuresis? Don't worry about the numbers here too much. For all intents and purposes, let's say it's the same thing as here, that you generate quite a dilute urine by the end of the distal tubule. I know the numbers are different, but don't worry about it. And what happens with an antidiuresis is you have a high ADH, and so the collecting duct is now permeable to water, and you can reabsorb water, and you can excrete a very concentrated urine. Okay, so what happens to the final urine really depends on the presence of ADH. So what I said in the slide before is for normal water handling to occur, you have to be able to generate a dilute urine here. You have to have a concentration gradient to potentially reabsorb water over here. And you have to be able to control the permeability of the collecting duct. So if the collecting duct is impermeable because ADH is suppressed, you excrete a dilute urine. If you have ADH present, then you can reabsorb water across the collecting duct and excrete a concentrated urine. Okay? Okay. So this is what I already said, and this is what I already said. So what varies with changes in water excretion is the urine osmolarity. Okay? I can tell in a patient if they have ADH active or not by looking at their urine osmolarity. So if someone drinks water and ADH is completely suppressed, and I take your urine sample, I measure the urine osmolarity, it should be very low. It should be like 50 to 100. If, on the other hand, someone is excreting concentrated urine because ADH is present, then their urine osmolarity will be above 300. It might be 400, might be 500, might be 800. It depends on how much ADH is released, and that will determine how concentrated the urine is. Okay, so this interstitial concentration gradient provides a gradient for water reabsorption across the collecting duct. It's created by a system called the countercurrent multiplication system. It's sort of nice to know, but I don't care if you understand it or not, as long as you understand that there's an interstitial gradient there. And it's maintained by the particular microcirculation of the renal interstitium, where you have capillaries that parallel the loops of Henle. They go in loops, and they're called vasa recta. And they have low blood flow, and they're able to participate in this countercurrent exchange idea. So you don't have to understand what countercurrent exchange really is, but I'll show you very simplistically sort of what it is. I'm not sure I even completely understand how this works. But the idea is that in the thick ascending limb of Henle's loop, you can pump sodium out against a gradient. So let's say here you can see there's a gradient of 200 that's maintained. So you're pumping sodium out. Water moves from here passively into the interstitium to equilibrate, and the osmolarity here is still maintained by more sodium coming out. So you see you're able to establish a gradient with a relatively dilute urine here and concentrated urine there. And as you lengthen the loop, you're able to step up the gradients, and the longer the loop, the higher the gradient can be. So it doesn't matter. I don't really understand it myself, to be honest, but it doesn't really matter. But if you have a long enough loop, you can have a gradient that goes from about 280 up at the cortex down to about 1,200 at the tip of the longer loops. Okay, and it all depends on the ability to pump out sodium and for this to re-equilibrate. And to maintain it, you have to have capillaries that parallel the loops like this, and we call these capillaries vasa recta. And what happens is, because they're in loops like this, as the blood is going down, it equilibrates with the concentration gradient, and as the blood is going back up, it equilibrates with the concentration gradient so that it's not washing out the solute that's accumulated there. Okay, if you just had straight capillaries going through here, then they would just pick up the solute and remove it and wash it out. So because you have them in loops like this with this countercurrent exchange, countercurrent just means you have that it's going in different directions and sides of the loop, you're able to equilibrate and not wash out any of the solute. The other condition is that the flow has to be low, because if you have a condition where you cause high flow through these capillaries, even though they're in loops like this, they won't have time to equilibrate, and you'll wash out a lot of the solute. Question? Yeah. No. The loop of Henle creates the concentration gradient. But the concentration gradient is there to allow water to be reabsorbed from the collecting duct. But the origin of the concentration gradient is because of the way the loop of Henle is designed. Because it's a loop, and you can get this countercurrent multiplication business taking place. Okay. So the concentration gradient in the interstitium is composed of sodium added to the interstitium by the thick ascending limb of Henle's loop. And when you have to have an antidiuresis, ADH makes the collecting duct... I know what I'm trying to say here. So most of the solute under normal circumstances in the interstitium is related to sodium. But if you have a situation where this is very dilute, stimulated by ADH, and you're reabsorbing a lot of water from the collecting duct into the interstitium, then you'll probably dilute the gradient in the interstitium, right? Because you're sucking a lot of water out of here down this concentration gradient, and it's going to take some time for this water to be picked up by the capillaries. So if you're really in a state where you want to conserve water, you don't want to dilute this concentration gradient. And so what happens is you call on urea to add to the interstitium to keep it concentrated. And so what happens is, simply, that when ADH is present, it causes the collecting duct to be permeable to urea as well. So as you're reabsorbing water from the early part of the collecting duct, the urea concentration goes up in the collecting duct. And when ADH is present, as you're absorbing water, this becomes permeable to urea as well, and urea moves into the interstitium. And then the descending limb of Henle's loop is permeable to urea, so the urea just recycles. Because you don't really want to have, you know, a never-ending pile of urea in your interstitium either. Your kidney's ultimate goal is to get rid of urea. So you use urea as a booster for the concentration gradient when you have an ongoing antidiuretic state. And this just shows it again here. As you're reabsorbing water, because ADH is present and the collecting duct is permeable to water, urea becomes concentrated in the medullary part of the collecting duct. In the presence of ADH, the duct is permeable to urea, so urea moves in to the interstitium, gets recycled around by going in here and back like this, and it boosts and maintains the concentration gradient. Okay? More or less. Okay, so thirst is an important mechanism as well, and an increase in plasma osmolarity also stimulates thirst so that you increase your water intake. You've all experienced this. If you eat a very salty meal, whether it's a, you know, salty pizza or Chinese food or any other salty food, you know, you feel thirsty for a while afterwards. And you feel thirsty because the salt load that you've ingested is causing increase in plasma osmolarity, and it's making you thirsty. And thirst is kind of cool because it works in an interesting way. You know, you feel thirsty and you go and you get something to drink. That sort of quenches your thirst, at least for a while. But half an hour later, you feel thirsty again. And so you go and drink again. So, you know, short term, you have these oropharyngeal receptors that know that you're drinking in response to thirst. And they sort of shut down the thirst for a while. But if you have to drink more, your thirst will reactivate and tell you to drink more. So we have the CNS thirst center that tells us to drink, and this makes sure that we take in water to go along with the salt that we've taken in. So to just review, if we take in a water load, this will reduce plasma osmolarity. If plasma osmolarity falls below 280, then ADH will be completely suppressed. The collecting duct is impermeable to water, and we're able to excrete a urine with a low urine osmolarity, a dilute urine. We're able to have, as physiologists would say, a water diuresis. If we have water loss, then we'll have an increase in plasma osmolarity, an increase in ADH, because the plasma osmolarity will be above 280. The collecting duct is now permeable to water, so we are able to concentrate the urine. This protects against further water loss. And at the same time, we stimulate thirst. Yeah? Not necessarily, which will lead to a rise in ECF volume. Not necessarily, because remember, water will distribute in total body water, so it doesn't have a big effect on ECF volume. The only thing that will affect ECF volume is how much sodium you've taken in or lost, not water. So you can ask yourself, what's the minimum volume of urine that you can excrete in a day? And, you know, we're in osmolar balance, just like we're in balance for sodium and water and potassium and phosphate and everything else. And so most people take in about 600 milliosmoles of solute per day and excrete the same amount per day. So if we have to excrete 600 milliosmoles per day for the average person, and the maximum urine osmolarity is about 1,200, then you can calculate that you can excrete your daily solute load in as little as 500 mLs of urine. Okay? So about 500 mLs of urine is about the minimum volume of urine that you have to produce every day to stay in solute balance. On the other hand, you can look at the maximum volume of urine that can be excreted in a day. And if you assume an osmolar balance of 600 again, and the minimum urine osmolarity is above 50, then you can calculate that the maximum volume of urine that you can pee out in a day is 12 liters. So what this means is you can drink up to 12 liters of water a day and excrete it without having a problem with water retention. But just keep in mind that this depends on how many osmoles you're taking in. So you can get rid of 12 liters of water a day as long as you're taking in 600 osmoles per day. But if you're really on a, you know, you're not eating very much for some reason, you're not feeling well, and you go through a long period where you're not eating much, if your osmolar intake is only 300 a day, then you're not going to be able to get away with 12 liters. Your maximum water intake per day will really be about 6 liters in that case. So it depends on the osmolar intake. Okay, I have to talk about this. I don't really like talking about this, but I have to just point out these terms to you. So there's this concept of solute clearance, and you can calculate the solute clearance or osmolar clearance as the urine osmolarity times the urine volume divided by the plasma osmolarity. And this really gives you the volume of urine that's the isotonic volume of urine that's required to get rid of the osmoles that you have to get rid of. Okay? And then in addition to that, you can have extra water or less water depending on whether the urine is concentrated or dilute. So when you have a dilute urine, when you're having a water diuresis, we say that you're able to excrete free water. That means that you're able to get rid of water without solute. And so the water clearance is the total urine volume minus the isotonic urine volume required to get rid of your solute. So you can calculate the osmolar clearance as we did just before. And then you can subtract this from the total volume of the urine. And if it's a dilute urine, then you'll have an excess, which will be the water clearance or free water clearance. Sometimes if the urine is concentrated, this will actually be less than this, and you'll have a negative value for this. In that case, in physiology, instead of referring it to as a free water clearance, it's referred to as a tubular concentration of water with this term here, the TCH2O. Okay, I'm pointing out these terms for you in terms of rounding out the physiology background, but you're not going to use these terms very much. But this is an example. So let's say if someone has a urine volume of 3 liters and a urine osmolarity of 250, and the plasma osmolarity is normal at 280, you can calculate that the osmolar clearance is 2.68 liters. This means this person needs to excrete 2.68 liters of isotonic urine to get rid of the osmolar load that that person has to get rid of. But this person actually peed out 3 liters, so this person peed out 0.32 liters in excess of this, and this amount is what we call as free water clearance because it's solute-free water, it's additional water that was peed out over and above the volume that was needed to get rid of solute. Okay. So I'm going to stop there for today, and I'm actually on time. How do you like that? So tomorrow, there are some concepts that I want to go over, talk a little bit about disorders of water, and add in the stuff that we missed about the diuretics, and I'll have time, there'll be extra time to answer any questions that you have that you don't understand. Thanks a lot.
About, but like you already talked about, it's about clearance. When you have like inner limb clearance.